From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Perry Mason was the subject of dozens of novels by Earl Stanley Gardner. Raymond Burr portrayed the world's most famous criminal attorney on CBS for 9 seasons and then later in a series of TV movies. The program was popular and remains popular on DVD today. My guest, Professor Thomas Leach, has written a brilliant little study of the series. His book, part of a TV milestone series, is called Perry Mason. Thomas Leach, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary.
First off, tell us a little bit about Earl Stanley Gardner and the creation of Perry Mason.
Earl Stanley Gardner evidently put a lot of himself into Perry Mason. Gardner was a wily, old-time lawyer who evidently was not above skirting the law when necessary, although he felt it necessary to stay within it, but who evidently thought of the law as rather a game to be played. He thought of himself as a wily maverick and wanted to write novels about a lawyer who would test the limits of the law while staying within them. A lawyer who was not so much a white shoe lawyer as a hard-boiled detective who happened to have a JD.
Well, in the novels, were the clients of Perry Mason guilty and then he got them off, or were they always innocent?
I'd be reluctant to spoil these novels for your audience, Gary, but...
yes, because there's only 7,000 of them.
I don't think I'm going too far to say they were innocent.
Yeah. Now, he wrote so many. I think he wrote more novels than Edgar Rice Burroughs. Or how many did he write altogether?
82.
That seems like a lot.
It is a lot. It's not as many as George Simenon wrote about Inspector Maigret, but it's about as many as Agatha Christie wrote.
And were they, literarily speaking, were they good books?
I think the short answer to your question is no, not very. Gardner himself didn't have a high opinion of them as books. He didn't think that he was a very good writer. He did think that he was a good plotter, and there I'm inclined to agree with him, if it makes sense to make a distinction between being a good writer and being a good plotter. His books tend to grab you very early on, if you're at all interested in this sort of book, and create a momentum that carries you along very quickly. They're fast reads. They're terrific airplane reads, and it's a shame that so many of them were written before people commonly started to take airplanes.
I guess you could read them on a train.
You can read them now on an airplane. I don't know how many of them are still in print now, but of course for years and years and years, they were big bestsellers.
Yes. You mentioned them. They're not great literary works, but they're fun to read because they have good plots. I guess you could say the same thing about this television series that was on for so many years and was so popular. I mean, the thing about the TV show Perry Mason is that in terms of drama, it's not very good. I mean, it's not nearly as good as some of its contemporary series, even on CBS, like Gunsmoke or The Twilight Zone or The Defenders, another law program that was on around the same time. Why is there such a large appeal of Perry Mason? Or do you disagree? Do you think it was a fabulous program and I'm completely wrong?
There's got to be someplace in between not very good and fabulous. But let me take your 3 points of comparison.
Okay.
The Twilight Zone is not really a fair comparison because The Twilight Zone is really a series of standalone dramas.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a continuing series. Rod Serling hosts it every week, but each program is complete in and of itself. Perry Mason certainly isn't like that. That is, the programs are complete in and of themselves, but they feature the same core cast, and they basically feature the same plot week after week. The appeal of The Twilight Zone is you never know what you're going to get from week to week. Gunsmoke, it seems to me, is a much fairer comparison, but there it seems to me not that Gunsmoke is better than Perry Mason or the other way around, but it's a question of taste. Sometimes you feel like a shootout, and sometimes you feel like a legal shootout. There are people who are going to prefer westerns and people who are going to prefer courtroom dramas. And when I was a kid, I greatly preferred the courtroom dramas myself. The Defenders, though, I think is by far the most interesting of your three comparisons. The Defenders was a legal program that looks forward much more to the kinds of lawyers that we see on TV these days in series like Law and Order and Before the Practice. law programs that explore questions of the relationship between the law and morality in a way that Perry Mason never does seriously. So The Defenders is a much more ambitious program. At the same time, it's a more open-ended program. It's not surprising to me. I used to watch The Defenders when it was in its first run on TV, and it's not surprising to me that it never gathered the audience that Perry Mason did. Perry Mason's a much more lowest common denominator program about lawyers. So I think I'd be inclined to say that people who really were connoisseurs of law TV would prefer The Defenders, but most people would have preferred Perry Mason.
Why? What was it about Perry Mason that made it so appeal to such a large number of people?
I think the fundamental thing was that it was so predictable. It inhabited its genre, that is, the legal whodunit, so completely that audiences who tuned in week after week after week were sure of getting a reliable product. You may not like that particular product. You know, you may have, I'm trying to think of other contemporaneous programs in different genres that would have competed with Perry Mason. Bonanza, for instance, the program that eventually drove it off the air.
Mm-hmm.
If you liked the Cartwright family, Bonanza gave you a highly predictable product week after week after week. This may sound condescending, but it's a little bit like going to the grocery store and buying tomatoes, butter, quarter chicken. You're not looking for a surprise. You're looking for a predictable product. The same thing when you're buying a used car. You know, nobody gets a used car home and says, oh, how great. It's so surprising. It's full of all these things I hadn't expected. And I think that in American mass entertainment, to a very great extent, people are looking for genre programs that deliver highly predictable pleasures.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned Bonanza, because I think Bonanza and Perry Mason suffer from some of the same problems, I think, when you're looking at them in retrospect. They both look very phony. That is, Bonanza was supposed to be outdoors, but it very rarely looked as though it were outdoors. It was always on a soundstage. Everybody in Perry Mason's offices, or whoever's office it is, if it's the victim's office before he gets killed, they all have those wood-paneled offices that don't really look real. The outdoors, looking out the balcony of Perry Mason's balcony, it doesn't look like you're really looking at Los Angeles, but rather a picture of Los Angeles. This sort of bizarre artwork that Perry Mason has on his wall. You ever notice those weird sculptures that he's got on his wall?
I'm afraid I would have to agree with every single word of this. I think that the offices of Perry's clients, the people that he goes to visit, for instance, they don't look as bad as his office, and it's a source of constant bewilderment to me how his office, which was designed for the pilot, so it had this awful paneling as of the very first program that was ever shot, how it was that anybody thought this would be a good look for a lawyer's office. And the only explanation I've been able to come up with that satisfies me is that it wasn't intended to look realistic. It's a highly symbolic space. The outdoors is supposed to show you that the view from Perry Mason's window is supposed to show that he's not completely removed from reality. And the paneling, I think, is supposed to establish his office as a kind of homey space. This seems incredible to me, but I believe that this is what the producers had in mind when the show first aired in 1957. Mason is a professional, he's efficient, he's no nonsense, he's very unemotional, as Raymond Burr plays him, and yet at the same time, his office is a place that's supposed to reassure the clients and to reassure the audience, you know, this space is not that much different from the space that you're watching from.
Well, Raymond Burr is a complex and interesting guy. His movie roles, I think, are kind of interesting to think about when you think about how he ended up being Perry Mason, because I think the first two roles that most people think of with Raymond Burr, other than Perry Mason, would be the prosecuting attorney in George Stevens' A Place in the Sun, when he has a dynamic scene as he smashes the oar down on the ground of the courtroom, and Rear Window, where he plays the killer. And that film is, of course, confined to a room, which most of Perry Mason is confined to a room or two.
Perry Mason is confined to more than one room, but you're right in that it does look claustrophobic. It's a whole bunch of rooms, and even its courtroom is just one more room. As for the roles that made Burr well-known before Perry Mason, you're right, he almost always played villains. Or, in, as in the case of The Place in the Sun, then I think his role as the prosecutor in that movie was probably the single most influential role in getting him cast as Perry Mason. A program in which he was originally invited to read for the role of Hamilton Berger, but agreed to do so only when he was promised that he would get a reading for Perry Mason as well. So Gail Patrick Jackson, the producer of the program, originally saw him as the prosecutor. Burr was cast almost always as a villain, but I think it's a little unfair to lean on him for his portrayal in Rear Window, since it's an open secret that in Rear Window he was consistently made up by Hitchcock to look like David O. Selznick, the producer who had been responsible for a number of Hitchcock films during the 40s and somebody with whom Hitchcock never really saw eye to eye.
They fought a lot.
Yes.
I never do that open secret, but you would know because I'm speaking with Thomas Leach, and he is a professor of English and director of film studies program at the University of Delaware, and he's also the author of the Alfred Hitchcock Encyclopedia. And his new book is called Perry Mason. I guess it's not a brand new book, but it's new to me, and I'm enjoying it a lot. Well, Raymond Burr also was a radio actor before coming to Perry Mason. He had a Western program. I can't remember what it was called, but I know he had one. And he really, according to your book, he really took, he was more than the star of Perry Mason.
I think that that's a fair thing to say. Perry Mason is an unusual TV show. I think it may be unique in the history of TV in that it was devised by the author of the books that it was based on. Earl Stanley Gardner had been approached, Earl Stanley Gardner had been approached by, I think, NBC, before CBS put this on the air, with a cash offer for the Perry Mason franchise. Gardner didn't want to accept this because he had had an unfortunate experience all the way back in the 1930s, very shortly after he started to write the books in 1933, with movies based on the Mason novels. A series of films were made by Warner Brothers, and after the first one, The Case of the Howling Dog, which was a pretty good movie, Warner's decided to model all of the sequels on The Thin Man, which had been a big hit in 1934. So they made Perry into a kind of a jovial tippler who was carrying on a romance with Della Street, made the mysteries a comic, and tried to lighten their mood. Gardner didn't care for this at all. He'd always maintained that Warner's ruined Perry. So as soon as he was able to get out of the contract, he did. And when Perry Mason himself went onto the radio in the 40s, Gardner maintained a strict control. He was very inclined to continue this control if Perry Mason was going to be on TV. So originally, this program was designed, piloted, and very tightly controlled by Earl Stanley Gardner, who had script approval of every single script for every single episode. It was only after a period of years that you could see control passing from Earl Stanley Gardner to Raymond Burr. Not that Burr started to write the screenplays or even approve them, but that Burr became much more closely identified in the public imagination with the role of Perry Mason than Gardner himself did.
I guess proof of that is the fact that when they tried to revive the series with another actor, it immediately failed. But when they revived it with Raymond Burr, even though he was much older, that it was a success again.
I think that that is a very compelling proof. Although I have to say, in Monty Markham's defense, he was the author on he was the actor who played the role in the new Perry Mason. That program ran almost exactly at the same time that the Watergate hearings were being broadcast. It was not a good time to launch a new program about a lawyer hero.
Right, I see. Well, so how did Raymond Burr take control? Did he actually take control, or did he just, you know, were there contract disputes and things like that?
Oh, no. This didn't involve any open breaches between the man who created the role and the man who inhabited it. It did involve a gradually greater emphasis on Mason as played by Burr as the franchise went on. And since it went on for a period of 9 years, there was plenty of time for this to happen slowly. A couple of things indicate the control passing from Gardner to Burr. One of them was that even though Gardner, at the time that the Perry Mason show began, had already written, I think, 55 novels, so it would seem that his novels would feed the show forever, this was in a time when broadcast networks broadcast 39 episodes of the program a year. So by the end of the second season of Perry Mason, by 1959, CBS had basically used up virtually all of Gardner's novels and had to start basing the stories on original teleplays. Gardner was still providing script approval, but he was no longer feeding the show in the same way. It's very interesting to look at the credit sequences as the series goes on. In the first couple of seasons, as the credits run, you can see Raymond Burr being handed a brief by the judge, and then smiling. And
that enigmatic smile. That's
right. Yeah, the smile that tells you that he's pleased, but doesn't give you the slightest idea what he's pleased about. Then he passes the brief on to Della Street, who hands it, or I guess who looks at it together with Paul Drake, and then the brief gets passed to Lieutenant Trag and to Hamilton Berger. So you see all of those actors. But the longer the series runs, the fewer actors, the fewer live actors you see in the credit sequence.
Yes,
Burr
it just
is always
a
there.
Picture of Burr after a while, right?
That's right. That's right. After a while, there's no judge. There's just a sculpture of a judge. And by the end of the series, you get a crane out at the end of each one of these credit sequences that shows you that Mason is sitting alone in the courtroom. There's nobody else there. So although Earl Stanley Gardner's name still goes on every single episode, Mason gets more and more identified with the person who's playing him than the person who created him.
The supporting cast remained intact almost the entire time. I know that William Talman was ill. But I think the relationship between the cast is kind of interesting. And I kind of think of Gunsmoke because of the sort of similar number of cast members. But there's a funny, I think it's kind of funny, the relationship between the characters and Perry, particularly with Paul Drake and Della Street. He never touches Della Street, but he always touches Paul Drake. Whenever Paul Drake walks into the room, Perry gets up and puts his arm on him, or touches him, which he never, ever touches Della Street. Have you ever noticed this?
Actually, just last night I was watching the pilot, The Case of the Moth-Eaten Mink, and he does indeed touch Della Street.
Ah.
Don't get your hopes up, Gary. It's not what you would think. It's still a 1957 touch, but
yeah.
Even so.
I
think, though, that your major point is certainly well taken. Like Gunsmoke, Perry Mason gives you not a family group, but a kind of quasi-family group in which Mason is clearly the father figure, Della Street is clearly the mother figure, and Paul Drake is clearly the sort of teenage son figure who wears loud sport coats and is constantly getting called off dates to run errands for Perry.
and where do William Talman and Ray Coleman, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name now,
Ray Collins.
Collins, right, from Citizen Kane.
Yes.
How do they fit into the family?
They're, of course, not members of the core family. You might say that they're William Talman is, of course, the quarrelsome uncle. I wouldn't want to lean on the word uncle, but they're figures who show you that you can still be family members even if you're constantly bickering. There's a great moment at the end of, I'm not sure which episode now, maybe The Case of the Lucky Loser, in which at the tailpiece after the final courtroom sequence has identified the killer, Mason and Della and Paul are having dinner together, and Hamilton Berger comes along, congratulates Mason on having achieved a not guilty verdict for his client, and then shakes hands with him. And when the others express surprise at this, Mason reads a couple of sentences from an article that Berger is alleged to have written for a magazine about how a well-tried criminal trial is a credit to all involved. So that there are many little gestures throughout the series that show you that Berger is really interested in justice, even though whenever he's in court, he always seems to be interested in nailing Perry's clients to the wall. As for Lieutenant Trag, the way that he's played by Collins really makes him kind of impish.
Yes.
He's subversive. He can even be nasty. He's always insinuating. He really is like an avuncular figure, I think, who always seems to know better than Mason and talks as if he were much, much older than Mason. And of course, William Collins was older than Raymond Burr. But he seems to me this sort of fairly dangerous uncle that you've got hidden up in the attic, who's got a twinkle in his eye, and who knows all these secrets, who knows where the bodies are buried.
I think
still part of the family.
I think all of the actors look much older than they actually were at the time. But I think there's something between Hamilton Berger's relationship with Perry Mason that's not that different than Richard Kimball's relationship with Philip Gerard on The Fugitive later. That is, there's sort of an unspoken affection between them, even though they're arch enemies.
I think that in the case of The Fugitive, this love-hate relationship gets pushed considerably further than it does in Perry Mason, in which it's perfectly normal, for instance, for lawyers, like, let's say, members of Congress, many of whom are also lawyers, to quarrel bitterly in public places and then go out to dinner at the end of the day. So I'm told that in 2010 that's not as common as it used to be, but I believe it used to be pretty common.
Yeah. Well, now they hate each other.
Well, now they profess to hate each other. Since I don't follow them to their dinner rendezvous, I don't know whether they're having dinner with each other or not.
What piqued your interest in Perry Mason to the point where you wrote a book about it?
Oh, I grew up watching Perry Mason. I think I started to watch the show when I was 7.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it all through my Wonder Years. And I have to tell you, Gary, it gave me a very warped idea of how the American justice system works.
And did it give all of America a warped idea?
I think to a great extent it did. I hope that not all of America got quite as warped an idea as I did. But let me tell you a story about me, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
After I'd been watching Perry Mason for, probably about a year, I remember that Reader's Digest ran a digest of George Waller's book, Kidnap, the story of the Lindbergh case.
Mm-hmm.
It was a long book, and they broke it into two parts. At the end of the first part, the Lindbergh baby had been kidnapped, and his body had been discovered, and the police had made an arrest of a man named Bruno Richard Hauptmann. And I read this. I think it was 8 years old at the time. And Reader's Digest promised that next month they would finish the story. So I waited for a whole month for this story to be finished. I was on tenterhooks. And when Reader's Digest came the following month, I was first astonished to see that the second installment was as long as the first installment was. It had never occurred to me that they would have anything other than a one-line sequel. He was guilty, he was innocent, because what else would there be to say?
Right.
And then after I read the story of this long, intricate courtroom drama, I was even more astonished to find that when it was over and Hauptmann had been electrocuted, there were still some people who weren't sure that he was guilty, after all. It staggered me to think that somebody could go through a trial and the trial would not produce an absolutely convincing account of either innocence or guilt.
And nobody stood up in the middle and said, I made the ladder and I wore the high heel shoes and it was me.
I like to think that even when I was 8 years old, I didn't expect that. But I do know from friends of mine who are attorneys and who have been to law school that in their courses in trial practice, one of the bromides that gets not drummed into them but drummed out of them is one of the things that you never, for instance, ask your client during initial consultations is, did you do it? Because if the client says yes, you're really over a barrel. There are many lines of defense that you cannot pursue. Instead, what you do is try to construct a story in which you draw out your client but also give both the client and yourself wiggle room.
Does Perry Mason regularly ask his clients if they
constantly
do?
Yes. In the very first episode, the case of the Restless Redhead, in fact, he not only does he ask Evelyn Bagby if she's guilty, but when she says no, he starts to cross-examine her.
Mm.
So it's a trope of the program, and I think one that I was not the only one who internalized mistakenly, that not only are people either always straightforwardly guilty or innocent, but their lawyers always need to know this in order to construct a defense for them.
And do lawyers, often the way Perry Mason does, are they detectives who try to solve the crime, or are they just interested in getting their client off?
I don't think I've ever met a lawyer who would describe him or herself as a detective.
But Mason clearly is.
Oh, absolutely. He's a much better detective than Paul Drake. Paul Drake isn't so much a detective as,
I
called him a little while ago, an errand boy.
Yeah.
Mason says to him, I want you to talk to these people. So Paul says, okay, and then he goes and talks to them. Mason says, I want you to look into this discrepancy. Once in a very great while, Paul Drake will come up with something unexpected. But that's really a fluke. Usually he can only find what Mason tells him to find.
Della comes up with just as many answers as Paul does.
Oh, Della is so, she's so nice. When I was seven, I wanted her to be my mother, too. No, well, she didn't have to come up with answers. What she had to come up with was hand-holding, although, as you point out, the hand-holding is not literal.
Right, no, they don't actually touch. But, except for that pilot episode. Let's talk just briefly about the later films. Do you consider them as part of the whole package, or are they kind of an adjunct? The film series actually lasted longer than the original television series.
From beginning to end, they did. That's right. There are, I think, 271 episodes of the original series over a period of 9 years, and there are 20 telefilms, but I think that the space between the first and the last one of those is longer than 9 years. So you're right. It's longer. I think that I consider them an adjunct rather than a continuation. They're kind of extended postlude.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly weren't planned as a series. That is the first of them, Perry Mason Returns. You can tell right from its title that it was planned as a one-off.
Right.
But the reaction to it was so enthusiastic. Maybe it was all these Americans who, like me, had been aching because lawyers had gotten such a bad rep through Watergate that they were dying to go back, you know, to this nostalgic past with lawyers were the good guys. And that's exactly Raymond Burr, who had not exactly aged gracefully,
no,
brought to that role. In the meantime, don't forget, Burr had gone on being busy. I mean, he played Lieutenant Robert Ironside on TV for almost as long as he played Mason.
And Ironside is just a lot like Perry Mason, only he's in a wheelchair.
In fact, the wheelchair was more or less necessitated by the fact that Burr had a constant weight problem. He had lost a lot of weight to play Perry Mason, but when you play the same role for 9 years and people are not jumping down your throat, you tend to gain it back.
Well, your little book is a fascinating one. The author, my guest tonight, Thomas Leach, and the book is called Perry Mason in the TV Milestones series. Professor Leach, thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Kerry. It's been such a treat for me.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode of From the Bookshelf, and I hope you enjoyed the program. Come back and see us again next week, or in the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org, or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank Professor Thomas Leach, author of Perry Mason in the TV Milestone series, for being my guest this week. And of course, I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.